Spend a minute or two there. Okay, we are at the Roman 1 on page 8. And as we come to this section, we're dealing now with some of the nitty-gritty that works to relates to the words and how the word worship is used in English. If you look this word up in an English dictionary, it will drive you insane if you believe in distinctions. Because the word worship has so many different definitions in an English dictionary, and when you begin to understand Scripture, it's just a scramble. Inevitably, they're going to call it praise. And it's obvious there's a lot of difference between praise and worship. And so the dictionary definitions really confuse issues. One dictionary, and we'll be back to more of this, the idea of paying religious reverence to. And so it involves adoration, thanksgiving, prayers, praise, and offerings in one dictionary that I had. Well, it's just like putting all of these, putting mixed nuts in a can and calling them cashews. That was exactly what was happening in the dictionary. And it's like everything's a cashew when it's they're definitely different. And so if you like whatever your favorite nut is and you're going to pick through the mixed nuts can, it doesn't mean it's going to be cashews unless it happens to be your favorite. But then you're not going to grab a Brazil nut and call it a cashew nut. And that's exactly what happens with these dictionary definitions. The English word worship comes from the root worth, or worthy. You can hear it with a W-O-R in the front. And it has the idea of being worthy or having worth. It comes from an old English word that is spelled W-E-O-R-T-H. They always didn't know how to spell then. We learned how to spell later. But that's the way they spelled it. And then there was Skype on the end, and that had the idea of a condition of being worthy. It involves a condition or a quality. It's kind of like in Greek when we think of an anarthrous form, a quality or character, a character of worth. And so in English it has that weight. Oxford English Dictionary supports this history, only including that worth actually, worth actually means worth. One of the books that I have related to word origins says worship began life as a compound noun, meaning virtually worthiness. It was formed by an adjective worth and a suffix ship, state or condition, and at first was used for distinction, credit, or dignity. Now, the guy that wrote that is an Englishman. And if you read the English literature very much in classics, they will talk about the king as being his worship, or one of the lords of the manor, his worship. And so you have that idea having some value. What is interesting is that one of these writers said that this did not have a religious meaning until the 13th century. So that post-dates Chaucer's Canterbury Tales. So when you can see how this has developed, it's kind of hard for us to imagine that the word worship didn't always have a religious connotation, isn't it? And so we take an English word, try to make it fit up with some of those words. It's no wonder people are confused. And don't think that they're not smart people. Smart people get confused too in many ways, and we would have done the same thing in that matter. And so the idea of worth could be directed in many directions, so the idea became very different. In many cases, only the context will determine what a writer means by worship in other literature. When you think about the word worth, worthy, can you think of a Greek word? Just for fun. Little drill. Okay, axios. Okay, axios. That's just a quick one. You'll grab it in a minute, I think, when you start thinking about axios. Axios is a term of weight and measures. It's funny, it's never used of worship in our translations of it. You'll be worthy in some translations. But it was weights and measures when you had a balanced scale. And I remember going to the little town of Downeyville in Gold Rush Country in the foothills of the Sierras of California. And they had an old bank, and they had the old balance scales from the Gold Rush days. And you had two pans on this beautiful brass balance scale. And they had weights to tell how much gold dust, how much weight there was in the gold dust that was brought. And so that term, axios, has the idea of having one side in balance with the other side, so that the worth was exactly what it was said to be. And so axios is a great word for that. And when you think about that, this is kind of the way I think. I'm trying to think of words from the New Testament that will help me understand some of these things. And when we talk about worship, it's a matter of our understanding of balance. You know, the best we can do when we worship God is that our pan is a little light when we have an omni-God, a great God. And the best we can think of, it makes our pan awful light, doesn't it? The longer we walk with the Lord, the more difficult it seems for us to understand how little we know about Him. Maybe I shouldn't say more difficult, it's easier on it. Somebody said the more you go to school, the more you really learn that you don't know. And that's really true. You know, the old sophomoric philosophy. The more you study, the more you know. The more you know, the more you forget. The more you forget, the less you know. So why study? You know, but as we mature in the Lord, we have that privilege of learning a little bit more, and you know, our balance never balances, but we give Him what worth that we can as we express it to Him, and we'll talk about what it means to worship, and that is the weight. Definitions of the word worship are subjective. What does subjective mean? It means that they match with our feelings rather than objective fact. That just tends to be that way. And so you can use the word worship in a group of people, and a mixed group of people, and you would go downtown Portland and you'd ask 10 people what worship means. You could probably get close to 10 different definitions because it's so subjective. It doesn't, it's just one of those words that does that to us. And so we can do anything we want in church and call it worship because it's so subjective. And so that drives us back to what it involves in the Greek New Testament. Now let's take a minute to just make a list. I gave you definitions from dictionaries, and I've given you quite a list of them. I went ahead and marked some of them just so I'd have it, but I gave you three or four dictionary definitions. But I thought I would just compile a list of how they kind of line up. The English definition, confusing prayer, church service. How many church bulletins said Sunday worship service? And how much worship was done in the worship service? If you want to define it however you want, you can do it. And so it must be okay. Let's do it with God's definition. Ritual. Religious homage. Religious homage. Devotion. They are very similar. Reverence. Reverence. Honor and love. It will be, it's funny how God works in the minds of those who do papers. Religious practice. So the dictionaries are just so subjective, it's not funny. So let's just work with a Greek word. When I say proskuneo, we're talking about the word that's translated worship. And we want to isolate to that. Now, when we talk about proskuneo, and we see where it is, it in the Greek New Testament occurs plenty of times to understand it, and we saw three of them just at one verse that we read in the beginning as we relate to it. But we need to do a journey so we can understand what it meant in that New Testament era and how it was understood, and it's not complicated. When we look at the word proskuneo, that's one thing. And we have no trouble with it in the King James English because it's always translated the same way. What is interesting is in Hebrew and in Greek, you have several words translated that way. But the sad part is, if you look at the word worship, you're going to see in your Young's Concordance. Do I want to sell a Young's? It's easy to use a Young's Concordance versus a Strong's. You look it up in Young's and you have all of the words translated worship in the Greek, and you don't have to look at the numbers in the back. And it's a lazy man's way to find something. No, not a lazy man's way. It is a quick way to find out what you need to find out. That's it. I mean, quick. You need to take the time. And you're going to see that there are 10 different Greek words that are translated worship. 10! And in Hebrew, we have 3. And the nice part is you have in the Aramaic only 1. And the funny part of that word is that it doesn't match any of the Hebrew words. And often there's an overlap between Aramaic and Hebrew. And so we really end up with quite an interesting package. You're wondering where I am. I hear pages shuffle. That tells me you don't know where I am. I've just slid right down to Roman 2. We're just moving into 2. And so, when we look at these words, it's very, very interesting. I want to read the first paragraph under 2. At this point, we will briefly examine the words in the original languages that are translated worship in the AV. AV is Authorized Version. Authorized Version is also called King James Version. In academic circles, it's usually called AV. In non-academic circles, it'll be KJV. But it's, you know, the habit, because I read in other places. So that's why I use AV all the time. A study of these words will give the student of the Bible some sense of the mindset of the translators. The AV isolates a majority of its worship translations to a single Hebrew word and a single Greek word. That is a majority. And so between those two languages, in which we have 13 different words translated, 2 of the 13 are the ones that are the focus. In many cases, it's just 1 or 2 times that those words are translated worship. And 99 of the 179 occurrences of the Hebrew shaka are translated worship. Shaka is the one we will look at. Now, it's kind of interesting when we pursue this. Our word for study, proskuneo is uniformly translated worship in the AV. Other Hebrew and Greek words are translated worship in the AV, each having a different meaning than the central terms for worship. And we'll see there's a similarity, and that similarity is what's important, because the similarity tells us that their understanding of worship was not spiritual worship, it was physical. It was a physical act, emotional act. It was not spiritual. That shift that takes place in Luke 4 is so, so important as we understand it. I've given you a chart of the Hebrew words on page 10. John 4, okay. What did I say? Luke. Oh, I'm all ready to go after something else. I'm down my notes further. Okay, yeah, John 4. That's key. Okay, I've got the 3 words that are used in Hebrew. And I put the total occurrence in the second column 20 times. Now let me explain what I've done here so that if you need to pursue some things, you can do it. I have put 2 tools that relate to Hebrew. The ES, I've got footnoted, is Ivan Shoshan's Hebrew Concordance. And it's a concordance that is in Hebrew. And if you get one and you don't, or you need one, get it so that you have the English or the Arabic numbers. They printed one in Israel that used all Hebrew. And so it used the alphabet for numbers, and it drove me crazy because I used it. And when I bought it with the Arabic, it was a lot easier to find. I mean, it's all in Hebrew. And so that's even Shoshan. Now it's only available in, well, through people who buy from Israel over there. I didn't get in a bookstore. I have money with me left. And that 20 times is this word Atzav. And so I put the number of times it's translated worship. One time I put the verse in. And then it means to make an idol. But look at how many ways it's translated in the King James or in the AV. It's a big mix. Worship is way down, you know, well down the list. It doesn't seem to make a lot of sense. But it has the idea of creating an idol as an object of some kind of obeisance. Then Avad is a word to serve as a slave. It's a word that occurs 289 times. It is all over. There are derivatives of this word. We have two or three nouns that come from it. We have some very interesting concepts. It's translated five times by the AV worship. Now look at that. You can learn something by looking at that square. Five times, what do you learn? Five times, four verses in the same chapter with the same translator in the King James. So one guy chose to do it consistently in that. It's kind of nice to see that little bit of consistency, but it means to serve as a slave. And it's usually translated serve or work. I'm obviously not going to put all the way it's translated because there's so many. Then shaka is our the word that occurs 172 times. I put even Shoshan in here because I didn't want to count them in Englishman's Hebrew. I forgot to tell you, EH is Englishman's Hebrew concordance. Doesn't hurt you to have an Englishman's Hebrew. Make sure you get acquainted with the English index in the back. You may feel totally incompetent when it comes to Hebrew. But there's an English index, and the citations are the King James Version, and you can see how a word is used in translating the King James with an Englishman's. But use the indices. A book is no good unless the index is going to help you. And that book has some super important indices that will help you do that, though you may not know Hebrew. And so 99 of the 172 times, it's translated worship. And it has the idea of bowing oneself down. To bow down, and we'll be dealing with that more. And you can see it's just translated bow 51 times. So between worship and bow, you have 150 of 172 times. So it gives you that sense, the idea of bowing down. One reason it's translated worship in some context is because it uses verbs that describe falling down, as in the passage we have at the beginning of the paper. So this gives you some statistics that will help you. I put the Aramaic word. It's the word sagad. And on top of page 11, it occurs 12 times. And those 12 times are in the Aramaic section of Daniel. Can you guess the event in which that word would be used? It's called Hebrew chilling in the fiery furnace and bowing down to the image that Nebuchadnezzar made and worshiping, and it's translated worship in the AV all of those times. And so it's kind of interesting to see that. And in each of these cases, the main words all deal with a physical act. In fact, in Hebrew, it often is found with nafal, which means to fall, and it is often found with the word af. And the word af means nose. It means to fall on your nose. In other words, scoop dirt with your nose. I mean, that's called obeisance. That's called, you know, really a physical action, and that's important to us when we understand it. Now, there are seven Greek words translated to worship, and that I've got the chart beginning at the bottom of 11. I'm writing notes to myself and trying to see what I'm trying to say. There's some remodeling that needs to be done with the sentence structure is what I'm looking at. Okay, doxa. Doxa. Did you sing the doxology? How long has it been since you sung the doxology? Doxa is a word that means glory. You are going to be well exposed to the word glory in this forum. My brother graciously, I don't think with reluctance, agreed to take some time so that I could do what I did before the forum and went off to see another part of the world. And his material is going to involve doxa, and that's the word glory. And I think about it, I think this is going to be a pretty intimate kind of forum when you talk about the glory of God. And that's 168 times the word doxa is found in the Greek New Testament, and then one time it is translated in Luke chapter 14, worship. You know, why did he even list it? Now, the percentages aren't very good here. Eusebeo. To be reverential or pious, it, in this form, it's a verb form, it's found twice. And I need to explain my stuff here. EG is Englishman's Greek. It's the same kind of situation as with Englishman's Hebrew. Again, enjoy the indices, they are helpful. Smith is a little tool that has charts on it for counting. It's a fast way to tabulate. And without Smith, I would be frustrated sometimes. I'm not always that patient. You know what happens when I try to count? If I wear my glasses, my bifocal line gets in the way. And then I miss my counts and have to go back and do it 3 or 4 times. It just never fails. That's why I don't like to wear my glasses. One time. Thraiskia is found one time in Colossians 2:18. If you've been there, you've probably done the study on it. It's religious observance. It's usually translated religion. Laterouo, can't pronounce it today, 21 times in the New Testament, and four times in there, twice in Acts, once in Philippians, once in Hebrews, and that's another, render religious service. That's material that I've done some work on that in the Priesthood of the Believer book. We did work on the Trielatrao, Latergeo, those words. And you can see those occurrences. Neokaros, I always have to laugh, they translate it worshiper, and you go back and you look at the word, it's funny how the language developed. The word for temple is generally used in grace revelation of the Holy of Holies. But it has the idea of a temple sweeper. So if you're a janitor in a temple, you can be called a Neokaros. Is that what only occurs once in the whole? Then you have Sebamai terms, and of the Sebamites, 8 of the 13 are translated worship, and it has more the idea of venerating. And you have a list, but even so, it's only 8 of 13. Then the last two are our words. Proskunetos only occurs once, John 4:23, and 60 times. So we've got a lot of them. And I let the cow out of the bag with the definition of proskuneo. And you'll see the definition. To kiss toward. To kiss toward. And so when you worship, if you have a good pucker, it works better. Now, I better erase that little part of the name because that gives us some idea. Now, let's go after the word. Page 13, the focus of the paper is on proskuneo, which is translated worship in the AV. The New American Standard Version translates it fairly uniformly. Of the 60 occurrences, 52 of them are translated worship, but it translates a bow down 7 times and prostrate oneself 1 time. So they decided to be a little different. If it was the other way around, I'd be a lot happier with the New American Standard than I, but with King James, I'm pretty happy with it in that matter. Now notice, when you look at the chart, that this is, it's a dominant word in the Gospels and in Revelation. The Gospels and Revelation. And so you look at the Gospels, and if we took out John 4, we'd only have two of them in the Gospel of John. But you look at those and you add those up between Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, there are 29 of them. 29 out of the 60 occurrences. So almost half are in the Gospels. Look at Revelation. It's nice to have it in Revelation because it helps us understand what it's going to be like in the heavenly throne room. And what it's going to be like. If you want help with the heavenly throne room, we have an expert in our presence, and Sasha's been working on the heavenly throne room. I have to needle him a little. He's been thinking about it. But this thing of proskuneo is found in Revelation, and we will be involved in proskuneo in the heavenly throne room. Because you have the 24 elders representing the church, that will be proskuneo. With them are four beasts, four cherubim, will be proskuneoing. And because of the things they say, it will help us understand a little bit about worship. It's very interesting, that kind of a response. Well, that narrows it down, and all we have are four occurrences in Acts and the three in the other. And so we have a limited amount of material that we will want to work in this matter. Proskuneo, where does it come from? What is involved with this word? Oops. Let's stop there before I go. I need this one here. I forgot. I put things up here that I don't put on my paper. And that is, all of these terms that we have usually involve a bowing or doing obeisance or physical submission, falling on the face, acting like a slave. It's usually a physical activity. It's a physical activity. If you could not move your hands and feet, could you worship? Of course you could. But with these definitions, you'd have a terrible time. Because you couldn't find a word that says okay. Because they all involve, when they say, well, there's an attitude behind an act. And that's the answers that I keep hearing. I've got a little book up here by A.P. Gibbs. And the title is Worship. It's an interesting book. I got it back in seminary days. And I took the time to do some skimming through the book. I wasn't going to read the whole thing because I was busy reading another book. And in reading this, I found out he was using a part of the other book more than he should have. I got so tired of reading Exodus and reading, if I start thumbing, here's Shaddai, you know, like that. And you can thumb through, you get Gospels, Exodus 20, here's Exodus 20. What's Exodus 20? The 10 words. Exodus 19, all the Lord has spoken we will do. Beautiful illustration four, and the provision of God's redemption is found in Exodus 20. God's redemption in Exodus 20? I don't know, do you call a whipping and redemption? I mean, the 10 commandments were at Psalm 37. That's where, this is typical of what happens as far as definitions of this word. Now, it just becomes very much that. Here we go. And this is where we want to go. Here's the breakout of the chart. We've already looked at it. Now we break it. Pros, toward, facing. Pros, kuneo. Kuneo means to kiss, and so it means to kiss toward, to bow down and kiss one's feet, garment, or the ground in front of. Interesting. That comes from lexical definitions, part of which you have in your paper. And so it's kissing toward. It is an action before it is an attitude. And you say, well, you don't act unless you have that attitude. It's really interesting when we start looking at how this word works before grace. And we're going to take the time. Now, on page 14, I gave you a list of definitions. And I pulled it out of, you know, your major or some of the consequential ones, so you have them in your... I gave you the whole thing out of the articles in these tools. Freiberg is in the analytical lexicon, his definition. But you'll see it says, a sense of bow down to kiss someone's feet, garment him, or the ground in front of him. Worship or veneration, falling face down in front of someone. United Bible Society lexicon says to fall down and worship or fall at another's feet, to bow low, to kneel. You see the physical action in these definitions. They understand to some extent. And UBS is they're generally a bunch of liberal guys. They're quick to try to find some other way out a lot of times. Lonida. In their Greek-English lexicon, translated it to express it by attitude and possibly by position of one's allegiance to and regard for deity, to prostrate oneself in worship, to bow down, and worship, to worship. And then down in the next article in 17.21, it says to prostrate oneself before someone as an act of reverence, fear, or supplication. I read those three words there, reverence, fear, or supplication. I am thinking in terms of particularly verses that they pull that from. Can you think of someone who proskuneoed somebody before they asked him for some help? You have illustrations of those who came to Jesus and they prostrated themselves before him before they asked something. And we're going to be looking a little bit at that so you can see that. I don't think I need to go anymore, except you're going to see the salam, which was an Arabic term. Thayer has it in there, to make a salam. And that was to fall down before an Oriental potentate, or an Arab potentate. And you can read the rest. Classical Greek, Liddell and Scott, I have pulled them to do obeisance to gods, to fall down and worship. Prostrate oneself before kings and superiors. The Septuagint Greek it says to prostrate oneself, to salute in the Septuagint. That's my notebook. I have all of those passages where that's found because it was interesting to dig the background out. So this idea of prostrating oneself before another has the idea of humiliation. So the lexical definitions, this is the overview. Worship or venerate by of a divine object, to do obeisance to venerate, prostrate oneself in worship, fall upon knees and touch ground with forehead in profound reverence and homage. You don't like to do things that you don't want to do. I was put in a position when I was in Israel to force myself, to be forced to do some proskuneo. And I had to bow down and they make you do it. It's very interesting how they do it. The picture we have here is of the Church of the Nativity in Bethlehem. Now, it's hard to see. I wish I'd have gotten a better picture of the doorway in. But you can kind of see here this arch. That was the original door. It's about 5 or 6 feet thick. When you're that tall, maybe a little lower, I have to think about how I had to bow. to go into that place is called enforced humiliation. That's called the door of humiliation. You have to bow to get in. And that's the way it is. They did that on purpose. And like I say, they call it the door of humiliation. You have to bow down. So I had to bow down to get in to see this sight in this matter. Now, what is this? This is in the Church of Nativity. I don't know if you can see, there's like a bench over here, but it's kind of hidden. In order for to go to the multi-pointed star, which is supposed to mark the place where the manger was, and that's not me. In order to do that, now you see this guy is kissing the star. That was one of my kiss pictures. So he was kissing toward. You had to get down and crawl under this table to make it work. Enforced humiliation. This is in the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. It's obvious I didn't take this picture because there were so many people there you could hardly do anything. What a weird place. But it's a building within a building. No, wait a minute. Yeah, this... And you see, this is where Christ was supposed to be crucified. But see here? Looks like a table there. The stone is down here. So you're forced, if you want to look at the stone, to be humble. And get down and crawl in there. I couldn't even get near it. It was really, I was off over to this side at one point. There's my son-in-law. There was one of our group, had her head covered, had a RC background. See, he's bowing down. Now, where is he bowing? This is in a doorway to the tomb, to where the traditional site of the tomb is. So in order to go in the tomb, you were forced to be humble and bow down. And so I caught George in the act. Now you look at that and you can't tell. That's where he hit his head was, up above that door. And that's just a building in the middle of that Church of the Holy Sepulchre. They force you to be humble. So you have a worshipful attitude. Isn't that something in this world we live in? You know, talk about froth. People worship a lot of directions. And this is the outline of this next section. I have a chart of this. And I don't want to look up every passage, but let's just take the time, take a moment, because I didn't, I was going to put them up on here, and I had other plans, and was just going to let you do it. But the homage to men, let's go to Acts 10:25. Okay, let's read. Peter is on his way to Cornelius' house, verse 24, and the morrow after they had entered into Caesarea, and Cornelius waited for them and had called together his kinsmen and near friends. And as Peter was coming in, Cornelius met him and fell down at his feet and worshipped him. Okay, homage to men. And remember what Peter said in the next verse. He says, stand up, I myself also am a man. Now remember, Cornelius had a visitation from an angel. And so Peter shows up, and so he did something that would have seemed normal had an angel or God appeared to him. But he fell down before Peter, and Peter didn't come with a cloud of glory or with smoke or anything like that. Peter came in a physical presence, just like I'm looking at you and you're looking at me. And he came in, and Cornelius, what does he do? He falls down and worships him. And here we come to the Greek word pipto. to fall down. It doesn't look like pipto if you're looking at an interlinear, but that's our root. Let me double check my root here so I can see it. It's pesoin. It doesn't look like pipto, but that's the root. And so falling down and worshiping. Physical falling down. Let's look at, that's homage to men. You can look at the other passages. Have fun in Revelation 3:9. It's one of those mysteries for the church. And it says that there will be those who will fall down and worship before the church individuals. It's an interesting mystery. Sorry to do that to you. We don't have time to mess with it. Homage to angels. Revelation 22. Revelation chapter 22, verse 8. And I, John, saw these things and heard them. And when I had heard and seen, I fell to worship before the feet of the angel that showed me these things. He fell and worshiped at the feet of a being that was superior. John was a little lower than the angels. How do we know? Because Christ took on a form a little lower than an angel. And he fell down and worshiped him. And he says, don't worship me. I'm a fellow servant. I like that together, servant, when he does that. Then the homage to demons in Revelation chapter 9 and verse 20. Homage is done to demons. And the rest of the men which were not killed by these plagues, yet repented not of the works of their hands, that they should not worship demons, and idols of gold and silver and brass and stone and of wood, which neither can see nor hear nor walk. And then he goes on and talks about other parts of the works of the flesh that they didn't repent of. So you see, they worship demons. They weren't supposed to. I don't know how many people worship demons today. I'm afraid there's a lot more than we want to admit in that matter. Homage to Satan. Luke 4 and verse 7. Worshiping towards Satan. Now I know when I said Luke 4 back before, this verse was kind of in the back of my mind. Because I knew we were coming. Okay. Luke 4, verse 7. Satan's second temptation of Christ. If thou, second person singular, therefore will worship me, all shall be thine. And so that was one of the temptations, was to have our Lord Jesus Christ fall down before him and do obeisance to him, do homage. And you can look at the other passages too. I should have probably gone to 13 of Revelation because we can get a lot on that one. Let's go to Revelation 14, and I'm just going to look at 9 and 11 because they both deal with a beast. Remember, the first beast of Revelation is a man of lawlessness, and he will demand worship. It's kind of interesting how that works when we study this, because he makes them worship not only himself but his image. And you have a double whammy. And in 14:9. I'm dyslexic. I was in 9:14. Says, and the third angel followed them, saying with a loud voice, if any man worship the beast and his image, and receive the mark in his forehead or in his hand, the same shall drink the wine of the wrath of God, which is poured out without dilution into the cup of his indignation. Remember, indignation means outward burning of, or outward display of inburning of wrath. And he said, and he shall be tormented with fire and brimstone in the presence of the holy angels and in the presence of the Lamb. And the smoke of their torment ascended up forever and ever, and they have no rest day or night, nor worship the beast in his image, and whosoever receiveth the mark of the beast. So you see, there was worship, obeisance, homage given or will be to the beast and to his image. And don't forget that the second beast of 13 is the one who's a false prophet who encourages that very worship. And again, it's a physical act on it. It's just, when you think of it, think Daniel. You know, when Nebuchadnezzar said, you've got to worship my image. You know, you're going to image. That means, they had to show it physically. It was absolutely a physical action, and that's what he was talking about here. Homage to idols, be the last one I want to look at here in Acts chapter 7 and verse 43. It's one of our Acts passages. Sometimes we can lever through some of these. Acts 7 and the verses 43. You want to have some fun with some history, evaluate Acts 7. And then tell me where our friend Stephen got his PhD in history. A PhD in Jewish history. It is just absolutely amazing the way that Stephen gave blow-by-blow account of Jewish history. And so here in Acts chapter 7, and verse 43, he says, let's go ahead and do this. Yea, ye took up the tabernacle or tent of Moloch, and the star of your god Remphan, figures which you made to worship them, and I will carry you away unto Babylon. And you have two deities identified here by name, by Stephen, like I say. The guy has a tremendous knowledge of Jewish history. And he says, this worship was something you did which led to the Babylonian captivity. So your idolatry led you into a land of idolatry so you could function among other idolaters. And he was kind of rubbing their face in it with his whole sermon in many ways. This is just an aside quickly, and that is, the Holy Spirit... You know, we're early in Acts, and you have that playful kind of feeling. And I think this is a manifestation of how the Holy Spirit controlled him rather than play Ra'o. Because he certainly gave some awesome detail. Have fun with it. If you want to review the history of Israel, go back and work on that sermon. It's a great place to go on that. Now, some context that will set us up. During Christ's earthly ministry, men worshipped him based on their emotional and spiritual responses. We'll be talking about that. That's part of the chart. We have Jesus as King of the Jews. Matthew 2:2, remember the wise men came, and he was going to be King of the Jews. Matthew 2, worship to the Son, or did homage was done to him. We'll talk more about that. But remember, if you were going to do homage in the Old Testament, you went to where the tabernacle was, or you went to where the temple was. And last night in evening school, we were discussing the issue when David brought part of the tabernacle from Shiloh, and you had a split personality in the tabernacle. And not a split personality, that was a bad thing to say. There was a division between. And David wanted to build that temple so bad he could taste it, and he was unable to do so. But that was the physical activity related to that physical location. Now, we take Scripture literally, right? We take it for what it says. We accept it in a very normal way. We accept figures of speech as they are, and as a result, we are dispensational. Scripture teaches us that God does things differently with different peoples in different dispensations, and all are saved by God by grace through faith. But there's a different object of faith in different dispensations. How could a Cain have believed in Jesus Christ who had not yet been crucified? That was an interesting issue. There was an issue of shed blood that he could not, and God hated him, which is very interesting. But how in the world could a Jew of the tribe of Dan believe in Jesus Christ and be saved? Their object of faith was different. Now, if you were in Dan and you were living in the era of Solomon, after the temple was done, in order for you to worship, you would go to Jerusalem to worship. And you would go there and do obeisance. Why? Why would you do that? Because the object of faith was different. The object of faith was that the one who was dwelling between the cherubim in the Holy of Holies in the temple was the creator of the universe. That was the object of faith. The object of faith was he was the creator of the universe, and that meant he was the creator of all things. And they believed that he had something to do with his people. But they didn't have the keys that we have. That was an object of faith. The content of their salvation was different. And there are people that don't like us as dispensationalists to be so narrow-minded. When we say that when God promised Abraham in Genesis 15, land. A land from the river of Egypt to the Euphrates River. You know, we take it literally. And so their anticipation, the content of their salvation, involved that land. We understand that. And so when we come to this subject, we need to realize that God deals with people in different ways at different times. And so I broke out a chart on the bottom of 17, and on the bottom of 17 it's broken out by law and grace and then future worship in heaven. It just systematizes it. It gives you a chance to wander around and try to figure some of these things out. And you'll notice in the dispensation of grace I got a lot of John 4, because he says, now is. It's changing right now. In the immediate future, and we'll talk about that. So I believe there's an overlap because of and so I've included John 4 and with a purpose. Now let's take a real quick survey, and I have written passages in here because I knew I was going to need to elaborate, and even though I picked up some extra time from the latter part of this paper, I'm going to use the lever. The wise men, the magi. Remember the term translated magi wise men is magi, came to worship the king of the Jews. And after the birth of Christ, this fascinates me how people just don't know how to read the Bible. Go to the Church of the Nativity and they will just about tell you where they put their camels, you know, when they brought the thing. I mean, it is just amazing. I mean, it was after he had been born. Why did Herod kill children up to 2 years old? Because they knew there was a bigger window than he wanted. And it was they relocated. And so, it's so interesting how Scripture is too clear. Tradition is really fuzzy. And so they came to worship him and to bring gifts. These magi were men who were scientists as well as religious men. Why do we know that? Because their response to a star and their understanding of the uniqueness of that star compared to all of the stars in the sky. They knew it was not a planet. Whatever they called planets at that time. Wherever they came from, we don't know. You know, the word planet means wanderer. And so when you look at the planets are not in an order. They move across the sky, and so they wander. And so they use plane as that word. They knew it wasn't a comet. And why do we know that? Didn't have a tail. And they would have had a word for that. They call it an astar, a star. And so it was an unusual, abnormal kind of thing, and somehow they knew it tied to the king of the Jews. It may have been part of a ministry of the Holy Spirit in revealing it to them. A lot of people say, they followed Jewish tradition and that sort of thing. And so they came, and they come to Herod. And Herod, they say to him, "Where is the king, he that is born king of the Jews? For we have seen his star in the east, and are come to worship him." And so they specifically see the star, they identify it with him. And when they looked at it, how could they interpret that star as identifying it with a person who's king of the Jews without some divine revelation in the matter? And so they come, and they want to give him homage because they see him as a king that's worthy of homage. And he, Herod, sent them to Bethlehem and said, "Go and search diligently for the young child. And when you have found him, bring me word again that I may come and worship him." He uses that same word. "I want to do it." Do you see the sneer in his face? Do you hear that little edge in his voice? You almost can't you, when you read it? I can. I'm going to worship him. One of the churches had an artwork of the slaying of the infants. And Roman tradition was that an angel protected Christ. And the picture shows an angel between Christ and the Roman soldier as he takes a baby by the leg and beats it against a wall. Terrible picture that they have. But these came, and the king said that they would, and they heard, when they had heard the king, they departed, and he sent them to Bethlehem, and lo, the star they saw in the east went before them, and it came and stood over where the young child was. When they saw the star, they rejoiced with exceeding great joy. So it stopped. It was totally supernatural. And when they were come into the house, they saw the young child and his mother, Jesus, or Mary, his mother, and fell down and worshipped him and opened their treasures and presented him with gifts of gold, frankincense, and myrrh. And so they physically fell down and physically worshipped him, as they would a human king. It's interesting when we see that. We've read the Luke passage when Satan in the second temptation took Christ and showed him all of the kingdoms of the world. And it's interesting when we read that passage. I put it in the notes on the bottom of 18. Satan said to him, "All this authority will I give thee, freely give thee." And the devil said unto him, "All of this authority, will I freely give thee, and the glory of them, for that is delivered unto me, and to whomsoever I desire, I will give it. And if you will therefore worship me, all will be thine." And of course Jesus responds, "You'll worship the Lord your God." And in this instance, he showed him the whole inhabited world. What do we know about Satan? He's the prince of the authority of the air. He's the god of this age. Now, he wasn't then. That had to happen because of Calvary. And so he had this authority. And so he tries to get the human nature of Christ to act prematurely. And because of the link to the person, don't forget, when you think Christology, you have one person, and that person can choose, or could choose, to live in the realm of his human nature or his divine nature. And so as a person, he could do that. And so Satan was trying to work through his human nature to get to his person and thereby affect his divine nature. It couldn't happen. But what was he trying to do? He was trying to give him authority prematurely. When is Christ going to have that authority? When he comes and takes 2 feet and puts them on a Mount of Olives. That authority will be, had they accepted the kingdom when he offered it to them, it would have happened then. I feel almost blasphemous to say, thank God it didn't happen then. But it's not, because that's his plan. If they had accepted the kingdom, where would you be and where would I be? Yeah. Spell it. G R A C E. Grace. And so we understand that. Now let's take and look at Jesus and those who worshiped him in his earthly ministry. Jesus. Human nature, but just like any human being, but he exhibited his divine nature through that human body often. And so let's go to Matthew chapter 8. And in Matthew 8 we have a leper. We had quite a discussion in evening school on Monday night about why Jesus told them not to tell anybody about some of these things, when he knew they were going to anyway. You know, it was kind of an interesting thing that it would seem crazy for him to say, don't tell anybody, and then they go and you got to go to the priest. I mean, it's going to spread like wildfire in that matter. And so we had quite an interesting discussion about that, and I'm not sure I had the best answers, but it was kind of interesting to think about it. But in chapter 8 of Matthew, and let's go ahead and just begin in verse 1 in 8, and it says, when he was come down from the mountain, great multitudes followed him. And behold, there came a leper and worshipped him, saying, Lord, if you will make me, if you desire, you have the power to make me clean. Okay, now did you pick up the reed? I was translating it so you could see it. If you desire, he's not talking about flowers that wilt. If you desirously will, as fellow, you have the power. The word can is dunameo. You have the inherent power to make me clean or to cleanse me. Okay, that's his approach. And he worshipped him before he said this. He had dust in his mouth when he said it. That illustration? You know what I'm saying? He was on his face. When he said that to Jesus Christ, he's looking up at him with his face to the ground and says, you know, if you desire, you have the power to cleanse me. He was on his face before, and Jesus put forth his hand and touched him and said, I desire. I fellow, I desire. Be thou clean. And immediately his leprosy was cleansed. And this verse goes on and says, and Jesus said unto him, see, thou tell no man, but go your way and show yourself to a priest. So he takes off. He says, don't tell anybody. And he goes to a priest. It probably spread so fast we couldn't imagine it. So that's the leper. It'd be fun to go and look at these others a little bit more closely, but the ruler and his dead body, and I put the synoptics together for you here. This ruler of Israel is identified by the name Jairus. His daughter had died. He came and he fell on his face before the Lord before he confronted him, and he said, my daughter is even now dead. He didn't even say she was asleep. She was dead. There was no manifestation of a connection between an animating principle of the soul and the physical body. So she was dead. He knew it. There was not a question. And so he tells Jesus that she's dead. But come and lay your hand upon her and she'll live. Isn't it amazing? That he understood Jesus' power. Kind of interesting when I look at it, we don't have a John account, so we have terrible time trying to fit it in. This had to be before John 11. And remember in John 11, the shortest verse in the English text of the Bible is 11:35. Why did he weep? Jesus wept because they believed he could heal the sick, but they didn't believe he could raise the dead. Jairus believed that he could raise the dead. Some did, and some did not. I think it hurt the Lord more than anything else to know that Mary and Martha had that problem. Those so close to him had the problem of believing that he could. If you'd have come, Lord, you'd have healed him. Now he's dead, too late. It's no wonder he wept. They knew he had power, but they didn't know the extent of his power. Sounds like people I know. Doesn't it? You know he had power to do some things, but we don't understand how big it is in that matter. Then the next fellow that does, and he comes ahead of time, but it's interesting, does he come or the demon? The demoniac of the Gadarenes. This was the guy who ran around naked, lived in a cemetery, and remember the cemeteries those days generally were hollowed out tombs. So he took up habitation with somebody's corpse in whatever state it was in, and maybe several, as he lived there in the cemetery. And so he sees Jesus far off, and he ran. I like that. He ran to him. Treko is one of those words that, I mean, moved with rapidity, and he worshipped him, and he cried with a loud voice and said, "What have I to do with thee, Jesus, Son of the Most High God? I adjure you that you torment me not." Was it the demon that said that, or was it the maniac? But he ran to Jesus, and he falls on his face before he asks him anything. Okay? And he falls down, and it's interesting. Let's read down on the bottom two lines of the page. "And they arrived at the country of the Gadarenes," which is over against Galilee, "and he went forth to land. There met him out of the city a certain man, which had demons long time, wore no clothes, neither board in any house, abode in any house, but in tombs. When he saw Jesus, he cried out and fell down." The word fall down, you'll notice it's prospicto. It's picto with pros in front of it. He fell down facing him. Fell down facing him. That's even stronger. Then he we see proskuneo in the other passage. "And with a loud voice," he said, and we've read that. And we know the rest of the story. Some Jews lost their pork chops that they shouldn't have been raising in the first place. And that's, that was what happened. It's really interesting to go and see a place where you have no bacon, sausage, pork chops, ham, anywhere, because they're just kosher enough not to let it happen in that matter. Okay. Page 20D. Canaanite woman with the demoniac daughter worshipped him before healing. Let's read it in the verse. And it says, "And behold, a woman of Canaan came out of the coasts and cried unto him, saying, Have mercy on me, O Lord, thou son of David. My daughter is grievously vexed with a demon." So she came out and cried. Christ confronted her and said, "Why do you as a Gentile come to me as a Jew?" And so he rebuffed her. She approaches him a second time, and she falls on her face before him. And it says, "And she came and worshipped him, saying, Lord, help me. But he answered and said, It is not necessary," or somewhat translated, "right, to take this children's bread and cast it to dogs." And she said, "Lord, true Lord, yet dogs eat the crumbs which fall from the master's table." And Jesus answered and said unto her, "O woman, great is thy faith, be it unto thee as thou wilt." And her daughter was made whole that very hour. And she had thrown herself at Jesus' feet before she came back with the next appeal on the second one. Kind of interesting. He put her down as a Gentile, and she falls on her face to show obeisance to the Jewish prophet. But she didn't call him a prophet, she called him the Son of God. Think of it and why it's there. James and John's mother worshiped before she made a request for her boys concerning the kingdom. She came, and you'll notice, and I'll read the text, it says, then came to him the mother of Zebedee's children with her sons. Now, the Zebedee's children are James and John. And worshiping him, desiring, and let's just translate it. I put it in the notes so you see it. Asking for herself a certain thing of them. She uses asking communication, it's aiteo. She asks for her benefit. It's rather interesting. There is a parallel passage over in Mark 10 where it seems the boys had the same idea. Who originated it, mama or the two boys? You know, who's going to be in the right hand and who's going to be in the left hand? And it seems like there was a corroboration between them and who started it. We don't know because the synoptics don't help us in the matter. And so he said unto her, what do you desire? When she falls on her face before him, and he says, grant these my two sons may sit, one on the right hand and one on the left, in your kingdom. And she does it on her face. Wants to make points, as it were, beforehand. I don't know if you've noticed the order, and we've looked at all of the befores. There's a request made, and the final request. Now the next realm is the disciples and the Marys, where they worship him after the fact. And the Marys, take the first disciple. I feel like I've been here with all of you, and I haven't, because we preached through this material not that long ago about Peter, introducing the book of the books of Peter in services. One of these days we're going to get started in that. If I'd stay home long enough, we would do this. But Peter, remember the story. They were out on the Sea of Galilee. We were out I have a certificate at home that says I rode the Jesus boat on Galilee. And, yeah, it is a little humor. It wasn't when they gave it to me, though. but you're out there and they're talking about Jesus walking on the water. And I thought, I'm not that good a swimmer, but I could swim this far. But you get out on Galilee and you see what it's like, and that's in near the area of Tiberias, where it comes out. I don't know if you think of the Sea of Galilee up in the north. You have Capernaum and Chorazon. Why do I keep forgetting that other town? But anyway, the three of them up at the north, and then down just a little bit on the west shore is Tiberias, and so. Somewhere in between Capernaum and Tiberias is probably where Jesus walked on the water and Peter came out. And it was so interesting. That happens. Peter, we know, in his great act of presumption. Don't you ever call Peter a man of faith in his action. He was not. That is pure, unadulterated presumption. And he hops out, and then he sees, here, don't forget, Peter is a fisherman. That is his occupation. Why does he panic? He looks at the waves. A fisherman who sees waves that cause him to panic was involved in a big storm. And we understand it. He goes down. Jesus goes and lifts him out of the water and escorts him back to the boat. And so what happens? The disciples see this. He had fed 5,000 people just before this event. And so the storm comes, and they see him. And in Mark 6:51 it says, and he went unto them into the ship, and the wind ceased. And they were sore amazed in themselves beyond measure, and wondered. They were full of awe, full of wonder, be astonished. It goes on, for they had not considered the miracle of the loaves, and their heart was hardened. And so when Christ shows up with Peter, then they that were in the ship came and worshipped him, saying, of a truth, thou art the Son of God. Fell on their faces on the floor of a boat. Said, you're really the Son of God. Would you have done as they had and ignored dinner and ignored the feeding of the 5,000? Their hearts were hardened. They